This text was prepared by Diane Bean, Chino Valley, Arizona. The Rose and the Ring by William Macapus Thackeray. Prelude, it happened that the undersigned spent the last Christmas season in a foreign city where there were many English children. In that city, if you wanted to give a child's party, you could not even get a magic lantern, or buy Twelfth Night characters those funny painted pictures of the king, the queen, the lover, the lady, the dandy, the captain, and so on with which our young ones are wont to recreate themselves at this festive time. My friend Miss Bunch, who was governess of a large family that lived in the piano noble of the house inhabited by myself, and my young charges, it was the Palazzo Poniatis guy at Rome, and Messrs. Spillman, two of the best pastry cooks in Christendom, have their shop on the ground floor, Miss Bunch, I say, begged me to draw a set of Twelfth Night characters for the amusement of our young people. She is a lady of great fancy and droll imagination, and having looked at the characters, she and I composed a history about them, which was recited to the little folks at night, and served as our fireside pantomime. Our juvenile audience was amused by the adventures of Giglio and Bulbo, Rosalba, and Angelica. I am bound to say the fate of the hall porter created a considerable sensation, and the wrath of Countess Gruffanuff was received with extreme pleasure. If these children are pleased, thought I, why should not others be amused also? In a few days Dr. Birch's young friends will be expected to reassemble at Rodwell Regis, where they will learn everything that is useful, and under the eyes of careful ushers continue the business of their little lives. But, in the meanwhile, and for a brief holiday, let us laugh, and be as pleasant as we can. And you elder folk, a little joking, and dancing, and fooling will do even you no harm. The author wishes you a Merry Christmas, and welcomes you to the Fireside Pantomime. W.M. Thackeray. December 1854. Contents, I shows how the royal family sate down to breakfast, too. How King Valoroso got the crown, and Prince Giglio went without, three. Tells who the fairy Blackstick was, and who were ever so many grand personages besides, IV. How Blackstick was not asked to the Princess Angelica's christening, V. How Princess Angelica took a little maid, Vi. How Prince Giglio behaved himself, Vi. How Giglio and Angelica had a quarrel, V. How Gruffanuff picked the fairy ring up, and Prince Bulbo came to court, X. How Betsinda got the warming pan, X. How King Valoroso was in a dreadful passion, Xi. What Gruffanuff did to Giglio and Betsinda, Xi. How Betsinda fled, and what became of her, Z. How Queen Rosalba came to the castle of the bold Count Agenarmo, Ziv. What became of Giglio, XV. We return to Rosalba, XVI. How Hedzoff rode back again to King Giglio, XVII. How a tremendous battle took place, and who won it, XVIII. How they all journeyed back to the capital, Zix. And now we come to the last scene in the pantomime, the Rose and the Ring. I shows how the royal family sate down to breakfast. This is Valoroso, XXIV. King of Paphlagonia, seated with his queen and only child at their royal breakfast table, and receiving the letter which announces to his majesty a proposed visit from Prince Bulbo, heir of Padella, reigning king of Crim Tartary. Remark the delight upon the monarch's royal features. He is so absorbed in the perusal of the king of Crim Tartary's letter, that he allows his eggs to get cold, and leaves his august muffins untasted. What? That wicked, brave, delightful Prince Bulbo! Apostrophe cries Princess Angelica. So handsome, so accomplished, so witty the conqueror of Rumbombamento, where he slew 10,000 giants. Apostrophe, apostrophe, who told you of him, my dear? Apostrophe, apostrophe, asks his majesty. A little bird, apostrophe, says Angelica. Poor Giglio. Apostrophe, apostrophe, says Mama, pouring out the tea. Bother Giglio. apostrophe apostrophe cries Angelica, tossing up her head, which rustled with a thousand curl papers. I wish, apostrophe growls the king, I wish Giglio was. Dot dot apostrophe was better? Yes, dear, he is better, apostrophe says the queen. Angelica's little maid, Betsinda, told me so when she came to my room this morning with my early tea. Apostrophe apostrophe, you are always drinking tea, apostrophe said the monarch, with a scowl. It is better than drinking porter brandy and water, apostrophe replies her majesty. Well, well, my dear, I only said you were fond of drinking tea, apostrophe said the king of Paphlagonia, with an effort, as if to command his temper. Angelica, I hope you have plenty of new dresses, your milliner's bills are long enough. My dear queen, you must see, and have some parties. I prefer dinners, but of course you will be for balls. Your everlasting blue velvet quite tires me. And, my love, I should like you to have a new necklace. Order one. Not more than 100 or 150,000 pounds. Apostrophe apostrophe, and Giglio, dear? Apostrophe apostrophe says the queen. Giglio may go to the apostrophe, oh, sir, apostrophe screams her majesty. Your own nephew. Our late king's only son. Apostrophe apostrophe, Giglio may go to the tailors, and order the bills, to be sent into Glomboso to pay. Confound him. I mean bless his dear heart. He need want for nothing. Give him a couple of guineas for pocket money, my dear, and you may as well order yourself bracelets, while you are about the necklace, Mrs. V apostrophe apostrophe, her majesty, or Mrs. V, as the monarch facetiously called her, for even royalty will have its sport, and this august family were very much attached, embraced her husband, and, twining her arm round her daughter's waist, they quitted the breakfast room in order to make all things ready for the princely stranger. When they were gone, the smile that had lighted up the eyes of the husband and father fled the pride of the king, fled the man was alone. Had I the pen of A. G. P. R. James, I would describe Valoroso's torments in the choicest language, in which I would also depict his flashing eye, his distended nostril, his dressing gown, pocket handkerchief, and boots. But I need not say I have not the pen of that novelist. Suffice it to say, Valoroso was alone. He rushed to the cupboard, seizing from the table one of the many egg cups with which his princely board was served for the matin meal, drew out a bottle of Right Nancer cognac, filled and emptied the cup several times, and laid it down with a hoarse ha, 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 now Valoroso is a man again. Apostrophe, but oh. Apostrophe apostrophe he went on, still sipping, I am sorry to say, ere I was a king, I needed not this intoxicating draught. Once I detested the hot brandy wine, and quaffed no other fount but nature's rill. It dashes not more quickly o'er the rocks than I did, as, with blunderbuss in hand, I brushed away the early morning dew, and shot the partridge, snipe, or antler deer. Ah! Well may England's dramatist remark, uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. Why did I steal my nephew's, my young Giglio's? Steal, said I? No, 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 not steal, not steal. Let me withdraw that odious expression. I took, and on my manly head I set, the royal crown of Paphlagonia. I took, and with my royal arm I wield, the sceptral rod of Paphlagonia. I took, and in my outstretched hand I hold, the royal orb of Paphlagonia. Could a poor boy, a sniveling, driveling boy was in his nurse's arms but yesterday, and cried for sugar plums and puled for pap bear up the awful weight of crown, orb, scepter? Gird on the sword my royal fathers wore, and meet in fight the tough Crimean foe? Apostrophe apostrophe, and then the monarch went on to argue in his own mind, though we need not say that blank versus not argument, that what he had got it was his duty to keep, and that, if at one time he had entertained ideas of a certain restitution, which shall be nameless, the prospect by a certain marriage of uniting two crowns, and two nations which had been engaged in bloody and expensive wars, as the Paphlagonians and the Crimeans had been, put the idea of Giglio's restoration to the throne out of the question. Nay, were his own brother, King Savio, alive, he would certainly will the crown from his own son in order to bring about such a desirable union. Thus easily do we deceive ourselves. Thus do we fancy what we wish is right. The king took courage, read the papers, finished his muffins and eggs, and rang the bell for his prime minister. The queen, after thinking whether she should go up and see Giglio, who had been sick, thought not now. Business first, pleasure afterwards. I will go and see dear Giglio this afternoon, and now I will drive to the jeweler's, to look for the necklace and bracelets. The princess went up into her own room, and made Betsinda, her maid, bring out all her dresses, and as for Giglio, they forgot him as much as I forget what I had for dinner last Tuesday 12 month. 2. How King Valoroso got the crown, and Prince Giglio went without, Paphlagonia, 10 or 20,000 years ago, appears to have been one of those kingdoms where the laws of succession were not settled, for when King Savio died, leaving his brother regent of the kingdom, and guardian of Savio's orphan infant, this unfaithful regent took no sort of regard of the late monarch's will, had himself proclaimed sovereign of Paphlagonia under the title of King Valoroso XXIV, had a most splendid coronation, and ordered all the nobles of the kingdom to pay him homage. So long as Valoroso gave them plenty of balls at court, plenty of money and lucrative places, the Paphlagonian nobility did not care who was king, and as for the people, in those early times, they were equally indifferent. The Prince Giglio, by reason of his tender age at his royal father's death, did not feel the loss of his crown and empire. As long as he had plenty of toys and sweetmeats, a holiday 5 times a week, and a horse and gun to go out shooting, when he grew a little older, and, above all, the company of his darling cousin, the king's only child, poor Giglio was perfectly contented. Nor did he envy his uncle the royal robes and scepter, the great hot uncomfortable throne of state, and the enormous cumbersome crown in which that monarch appeared from morning till night. King Valoroso's portrait has been left to us, and I think you will agree with me that he must have been sometimes rather tired of his velvet, and his diamonds, and his ermine, and his grandeur. I shouldn't like to sit in that stifling robe with such a thing as that on my head. No doubt, the queen must have been lovely in her youth, for though she grew rather stout in after life, yet her features, as shown in her portrait, are certainly pleasing. If she was fond of flattery, scandal, cards, and fine clothes, let us deal gently with her infirmities, which, after all, may be no greater than our own. She was kind to her nephew, and if as he had any scruples of conscience about her husband's taking the young prince's crown, consoled herself by thinking that the king, though a usurper, was a most respectable man, and that at his death Prince Giglio would be restored to his throne, and share it with his cousin, whom he loved so fondly. The prime minister was Glumboso, an old statesman, who most cheerfully swore fidelity to King Valoroso, and in whose hands the monarch left all the affairs of his kingdom. All Valoroso wanted was plenty of money, plenty of hunting, plenty of flattery, and as little trouble as possible. As long as he had his sport, this monarch cared little how his people paid for it. He engaged in some wars, and of course the Paphlagonian newspapers announced that he had gained prodigious victories. He had statues erected to himself in every city of the empire, and of course his pictures placed everywhere, and in all the print shops. He was Valoroso the Magnanimous, Valoroso the Victorious, Valoroso the Great, and so forth. For even in these early times courtiers and people knew how to flatter. This royal pair had one only child, the Princess Angelica, who, you may be sure, was a paragon in the courtier's eyes, in her parents', and in her own. It was said as he had the longest hair, the largest eyes, the slimmest waist, the smallest foot, and the most lovely complexion of any young lady in the Paphlagonian dominions. Her accomplishments were announced to be even superior to her beauty, and governesses used to shame their idle pupils by telling them what Princess Angelica could do. She could play the most difficult pieces of music at sight. She could answer any one of Magnell's questions. She knew every date in the history of Paphlagonia and every other country. She... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.